Robert Moody or Bob Moody?
Either one.
Welcome back to the Valley. I remember when you took over the festival and changed the name, and you had this great idea. You wanted to be a festival in the sense of a celebration and all kinds of different things, and you've really done that. So congratulations.
Well, thank you very much, and it's very exciting. I mean, this is the 19th anniversary of the Music Fest, and for the first 10 of those years, it was called Desert Foothills Music Fest. And then you were exactly right. When I came on board, we changed it to the Arizona Music Fest. And part of that was to broaden the scope of it, not just from regional to state, but from really regional and state to national and even international recognition. And I feel very fortunate as an artist that a group of very dedicated folks, primarily in the northern part of the valley up around the Carefree Cave Creek area, those guys, they're the founders of the festival. When they said, let's start dreaming about what this festival can become, and I said, well, yeah, if we play our cards right, we could be, you know, like the Lucerne Festival. And they said, you know, well, what is that? I said, well, that's where some of the greatest, you know, orchestral members in all of Europe and to some great extent North America go and perform. And they said, well, that sounds neat. Let's try that. So here we have this festival orchestra gathering, and we have members of Chicago Symphony, Cleveland Orchestra, Philadelphia Orchestra, Boston Symphony, New York Philharmonic, Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, San Francisco Symphony, Seattle Symphony, Montreal Symphony. It's really pretty cool to know that Ricardo Morales, for example, principal clarinet of Philadelphia, is our principal clarinet. We've just garnered the new principal trombonist for the festival as the principal trombone of the Philadelphia Orchestra. New associate principal cellist from the Montreal Symphony, and on and on. And I think I've said this before, for me personally, it's like driving a Ferrari, but I think more importantly for the Valley and people who come to hear it, it's like listening and seeing and watching one of the, you know, greatest performing orchestral vehicles you'll get a chance to see in that neat festival setting.
Well, and it's nice, too, because the name change did this for a lot of folks here. Desert Foothills is great if you know where the Desert Foothills are.
Yeah, that's right.
When you say Arizona Chamber Music Festival, that's, wow, really?
Yeah.
And the cool thing is, too, and since we're here, you know, there are summer festivals elsewhere. That would be pointless unless you're going to have a gigantic air-conditioned dome.
Correct, correct.
But have a winter music festival?
Correct. Yeah. We garnered the name early on in my tenure, America's Premier Winter Music Festival. Now, of course, that was an easy slogan because there really aren't that many winter music festivals. But you're exactly right. We have something to offer here in the Valley in February, you know, that people can't provide in most parts of at least the Northern Hemisphere. So, by the way, I have to tell you, when I call colleagues who play in the Cleveland Orchestra or the Montreal Symphony and say, would you like to come to Scottsdale, Arizona in February to, you know, play in a festival orchestra, they barely ask if there's a fee. I say 75 and sunny, and they're interested immediately.
So long as they can get out of the airport.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah. They can get here.
One of the things, too, is the idea of a festival. You have all sorts of performances, from jazz to pop. But the classical side of it, even that's a broad spectrum. It's the festival orchestra, but you have standalone performances.
That's right. So we have New York, everything from a festival orchestra to incredible chamber music, Orly Shaham, piano. We had Jonathan Biss, piano, to great string quartets.
Pianist Orly Shaham is coming. Do you remember off the top where she's playing?
Where?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's playing at Temple Chi. Temple Chi has become a new venue for us, especially for piano works. We had Jonathan Biss at Temple Chi last year. This year, Orly Shaham. Orly is one of my favorite pianists. I've done a number of concerti with her, everything from the Beethoven 4th to Rachmaninoff 2nd. And she is just, she's an incredible player. She comes clearly from an amazing musical family, at least she and her sibling, Gil Shaham. But she's also just an incredible person, and that personality reads in her playing. One story I like to tell about Orly and her sort of connection and interest in making music available to young people. She has a series she does in New York at the 92nd Street Y called Baby Got Bach, and it's sort of introducing Bach and other great classics to very young kids. So I'm impressed with Orly on a number of levels, and I'm so happy we're bringing her here. Her piano playing, especially her classical playing, is just precision. It's so fantastic.
I had a chance to meet her when she was in the Valley playing Mozart.
Yeah.
And I can attest to the classical playing. And you're right. She's just such a delightful human being.
Yeah.
And then she gets married to David Robertson, conductor, and she kind of disappears for a while as she becomes stepmom and now mom.
That's right.
And interested in becoming, introducing music to not only her own children, but to others too.
That's right.
When I look at her program, I'm not sure you had a chance to look at it, but it's what you'd expect from a top-notch pianist who wants to delve into the instrument. There's Bach, there's Brahms, I'm assuming it's Bruce Adolf that's on the program. And then there's a guy here that it says, to be determined, that it's a new work by a composer that I got real excited about, Avner Dorman.
Yes. And all of this, the Dorman piece came from Orly. The idea for it came from Orly. And everything on her recital is hooking itself back to Brahms. So if you sort of take a look at the way the recital works, she uses Brahms as the thread of connection. And even the new works are going to have a sense of connection to Brahms.
Mm-hmm. Just a side note. If you can ever do the Avner Dorman piano concerto here, I'd be down with that.
Okay.
Have you heard it?
I haven't. I know it exists.
Okay.
Well, okay.
It's a great fun piece. Then there's always a Bob Moody and Friends. Usually we get to see if we can embarrass Bob somewhere or another. I was so excited to see that this time it's a local group.
Yeah.
That we found out a couple of years ago called Simply Three.
Yeah, well, I'm extremely proud of Simply Three, and I came across Simply Three, I mean the group under that name, the way I think many people did, just sort of, surfing around YouTube. And one video of someone leads you to another one or something like that. And I think I was looking for something for another group I love very much called Time for Three. And I know the guys in Time for Three and have conducted them a few times. And that took me to Simply Three, saw their videos, saw what they were doing, and then here's the reveal. Saw that two of them were both Phoenix Symphony Youth Orchestra students of mine. So Nick Villalobos on bass and Zach Clark on cello were my principal cello and principal bass with the then called Phoenix Symphony Guild Youth Orchestra. Now it's the Phoenix Youth Symphony.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, oh boy, was I proud to see that. And we've reconnected. And we're going to have a lot of fun. I'm actually going to do a few tunes with them on the Bob and Friends concert. I will sing, croon my best with them. And then, of course, they'll feature some of their own pieces.
It is cool. It's neat that you remembered having them as your principals in the youth orchestra. But it was also very neat that ASU now, they go to their professors and say, "We're thinking," and this is Thomas Landshut and Kathleen Rotaru,
mm-hmm.
saying, "We're thinking about doing this." And they both said, "Cool."
Yeah.
You know, it's a different world than when you went, well, I'm older than you, but when we were kids, you know.
It was, yeah. Well, I will say I have no, in 20 some years of, nearly 25 years of conducting now professionally, I have no greater experiences in my past than the experiences I had with youth orchestras. You know, the sort of impact that I felt we were able to make, the collective body, not just me personally, but we were able to make on, teenagers and their decisions about music, whether they became musicians or not, maybe they just used it to better their life. But I think it's the most important thing probably I've ever done.
Well, I'm sure you've heard it from them and other players too, but in case you haven't, I'll just remind you, it's a great thing that you were involved with them as long as you were. And it's one of those gigs that a lot of people don't want to do. So when somebody's actually excited about it and wants to be there, it's a life changer for folks.
I had the Phoenix Symphony Youth Orchestra for 7 years, and they were priceless, just some of the best years of my conducting.
The Festival Orchestra, the performances, are they all at Pinnacle Presbyterian?
All at Pinnacle Presbyterian. Three of the four are at Pinnacle Presbyterian. One is at Highlands Church, which is actually just down the road from Pinnacle Presbyterian. The orchestra performs four times in a week, so it's a pretty hefty schedule. Four times of three programs of quite significant repertory, and then one program which is a lot of fun and a little bit lighter for the orchestra. So that one concert we take to a different venue, Highlands Church. The other three are classical, completely in nature, and give a chance to really, show off this thing we've got, this incredible orchestra that's in town, and also feature some incredible soloists as well.
Well, we'll go through in order, and Jane can do her magic with how it all appears. I'm not seeing that one performance is happening at the church. Is that Tchaikovsky then?
It's Storm Large, which I wonder if that's how that's listed.
I'm not seeing it. What I've got are these four. No, I'm just looking at three.
Yeah, so that's what, so they've listed those. Those are the three classical performances, and then we perform on. So that's Tuesday. So opening concert is Tuesday night. Thursday night is the sort of Vienna kind of connection, and then Sunday is the Janáček Glagolitic Mass in Tchaikovsky. Friday night we are pairing with Storm Large. Storm is a phenomenal singer who does not come from the classical world. She started out in the Portland, Oregon, like punk rock scene, and then sort of even more even akin to like Nirvana rock, kind of garage rock, and then she made her way eventually to sing with Pink Martini, and so she filled in when China, I just forgot China's last name, but the lead singer for Pink Martini had left for a lengthy maternity leave. Storm filled in, and she sort of got interested in the orchestral world. Fast forward to last season, she sang the Kurt Weill's Seven Deadly Sins with Leonard Slatkin and the Detroit Symphony at Carnegie Hall, and she really is, she's the real thing. She's phenomenal. So she does the programs like Kurt Weill. For us, she's doing a program called The Crazy Arc of Love. And it's everything. She sings tunes from the Great American Songbook, lots of Jerome Kern and Cole Porter, down to Total Eclipse of the Heart by Bonnie Tyler. It's powerful stuff. And she's the most versatile, and she is a unique personality. She's also quite beautiful, sort of model gorgeous. And I think this is a concert no one will want to miss. It's really going to be great stuff. Plus, the orchestra gets to play John Adams' Short Ride in a Fast Machine on that concert, because I think that's what the experience with Storm sort of is. So we wanted to kind of grab that energy as best we could.
Which is one of those deceptive pieces that sounds simple, you know, but no. I got to go back, Storm. Okay, so you're a younger guy, but come on, did you find her because of the Carnegie Hall performance?
I did. So she came onto my radar because of the Carnegie Hall performance, and I read the reviews, and then I have been strongly affiliated with the music of Kurt Weill for my whole career. Right when I started, I worked for the Kurt Weill Foundation. I edited the score and parts for the Kurt Weill opera Street Scene. So I contacted the Weill Foundation and said, "Tell me about this person." And Kim Kowalki, he's president of the foundation. He, you know, that was the beginning of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So just so the audience gets an understanding, you get to play to John Adams, but you're playing with Storm. How does the principal trombone and the principal clarinet for the Philadelphia Orchestra at all the folks who were there, how do they feel about this?
Well, I think this is one of the other best things to say about this orchestra. We recruit very carefully with two criterion in mind. World-class player, finest player on said instrument we can find, world-class human being, great all-around lover of music. So not to say that there are, you know, curmudgeons or cynics in our profession, but we really look very carefully to make sure we find people who have a real breadth of repertory experience and who, you know, want to come to play in a festival for a week and not be sort of caught up in the same sort of very intense workforce mode that we all get into when we're back with our own orchestras, you know, in whatever place. So if I think about, for example, Ricardo Morales from Philadelphia or Brant Taylor, cellist from Chicago Symphony, these guys would be in a jazz club or a pop club as quickly as they would be at a recital on any given night in Philadelphia or Chicago in their free time.
But I think it would be surprising to audience members when they got into a classical, quote-unquote classical guy's car. What's in the CD player, you know? What are they actually tuned into? I think people would just fall apart to know what you're relaxed to.
If folks knew what was on my playlist, you know, I'm a runner, and the things I use for running, it's everything from classical music to the best of my high school, you know, soundtrack, which for me was like Kansas Journey Boston. So sort of a bit of everything.
Yeah, people would be stunned. Well, you mentioned Ricardo Morales and that performance, again, Episcopal Pinnacle Presbyterian, features, well, three composers that if anybody listens for long, they know they love them. One, the obvious ones are Rimsky-Korsakov and Mozart, but Jennifer Higdon's here too.
Yeah, that's right. So we have, and let me back off and make sure I remember what we're doing on that opening. I got my set right. Okay, good. I was going to remember which year we were doing Symphony Fantastique. That's next year. Yeah.
Okay.
It's good.
Okay. So the Higdon, it's a fanfare.
Yep. Jennifer Higdon is, of course, one of the great living American composers and probably most well-known for a work of hers called Blue Cathedral. But I've fallen in love recently with this fanfare ritmico. She wrote it at the turn of the century. She wrote it for the Women's Philharmonic, and it was her thinking at the time was about, 2000, thinking about the millennium coming and sort of how busy our lives have become. And she was thinking at the time with cell phones and with email and with just constant people being constantly in contact with each other, life just becomes layer upon layer upon layer. And that's really what you hear in this. It's a mammoth percussion production, I should say. So the percussion section, five players playing a multitude of instruments, and you get this rhythmic layer on top of layer on top of layer. And then the rest of the orchestra joins them eventually, and the same thing happens until finally the brass give us a great fanfare at the end. I talked to Jennifer, and I said, so now it's 2014. Any additional comments? And her comment was, well, the only thing I will say is I had no idea how exponentially our busyness would have increased in just a decade or so. Mm-hmm. She said, we didn't even know about Facebook and Twitter and, Instagram and all these things when I wrote this piece. And now it's even, to the 10th power greater than it was then. So it's a great piece and an exciting way to open an orchestral week. And then Ricardo Morales is playing the Mozart Clarinet Concerto, greatest clarinetist perhaps playing on the planet today, playing greatest concerto written for that instrument. It's the ultimate grand slam in my mind for this piece. So I cannot wait. No one plays the clarinet like Ricardo Morales, and I've heard clarinetists say this around the world. Just no one plays with the color and warmth and. It's something that he has for his very own, and I just can't wait to be part of that experience. Frankly, get to stand there beside him as he makes this music, and then we finish the concert with Scheherazade, one of the greatest works and the greatest sort of examples of tremendous orchestration that we've got in the repertory. And this concert features Frank Wang, who is our concertmaster. He is the concertmaster of the Houston Symphony, and if anybody caught the news this week, he is doing a stint right now as one of the final candidates for concertmaster with the New York Philharmonic. So he's in New York this month doing a huge series of concerts with them. We're very proud of Frank, obviously, and this is a chance to hear this guy play all the incredible violin solos in Scheherazade.
Peace that where's We're speaking on. I'm glad that's you.
Yeah, it's me, and I thought I had put it on airplane mode, and then we talked about looking up something in New York Polyphony, and I.
That's all right.
Took it off. I'm sorry about
that's
that.
Fine.
And it's back on.
Just as an aside, I know this because I was on the air this morning. November 3rd is the day that Scheherazade was first performed.
Oh, no kidding!
Yeah. So
wow.
Trivia you can only find at a radio station. Next performance is. Thursday, February 26th, again at Pinnacle Presbyterian, Beethoven, Bach, and the Blue Danube. Yeah. So when you have a program or a festival where you've got some jazz, you've got some pop, you've got a singer who came from the punk world doing, this is pretty standard, but you take all these great players with one of the greatest orchestrations, I think, examples of orchestration in the Bach, the Schoenberg transcription of the St. Anne. This just looks like it's, you got to tell the musicians, we're just going to have a fun night.
Well, that's the first thing that came to my mind. One of the first things that always comes to my mind when programming for this orchestra is what works should we choose that best, you know, for lack of a better word, show off this orchestra that best demonstrate the really wide spectrum of color available to a symphony orchestra when they're playing it at such an incredible level. So I know the Bach Prelude and Fugue on St. Anne as an organ work, of course, and I'm a huge fan of it in that manner, but the Schoenberg orchestration is one of the finest orchestrations out there. And so for that exact reason, I chose the piece.
It opens a concert. It continues with Beethoven. The Emperor Concerto, I'm sitting here. I didn't find out who's playing.
Orion Weiss.
It is? Okay.
Yeah. So we're bringing Orion Weiss, who came to the festival a few years ago to do a piano recital and was just loved by the recital crowd. He's also played with the Phoenix Symphony. I first met him when I was working as resident conductor for the Phoenix Symphony. He came and soloed. He's been a few times to Phoenix. He's a well-known name in the Valley. I got a chance to debut at Ravinia with the Chicago Symphony this past summer, and Orion was my pianist. So we love working together. I love working with him. And bringing him here to do the Beethoven Emperor, the Beethoven Fifth Piano Concerto. There's a little bit of a three B's going on: Bach, Beethoven, Blue Danube. But also the Blue Danube bit came from wanting to, aside from Bach, let the concert be a little bit of an homage to Vienna. So the Beethoven work, we're playing Richard Strauss' Rosenkavalier Suite. One of my favorite, and I'm going to say it this way, one of my favorite tone poems of Richard Strauss. It's about the greatest opera ever written, but this suite for me is important and wonderful to conduct as is Don Juan or Death and Transfiguration or what have you. It's just this incredible sweep of sound and texture that I love so. A lot of sort of Vienna homage here with this is Richard Strauss's, of course, his love letter to Vienna in that opera. And then to cap it all off with the most associated Viennese piece of them all, the Blue Danube Waltz. And I think people should know that if you only think about the famous theme that everyone can hum, that's certainly plays throughout the entire waltz, but the waltz is about an 11-minute piece full of amazing intricacy, and it does not stay in the standard oom-pa-pa mode all the time at all. There's quite a lengthy, slow introduction. There's a slow turn near the very end. I love the piece, and I lived in Vienna for a year as a student, so it brings back a lot of personal memories for me as well.
Yeah, the piece of the three B's there is that Brahms loved Johann Strauss.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's nice, too, because actually you're beginning and ending with two of my favorite orchestrators, Schoenberg, Richard Strauss.
Yep.
But if you're putting Johann in there, you realize this guy had game. This wasn't this guy really could write for the orchestra.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. And well, anyone who has made their way through the overture to Fledermaus knows that. But even more so, I think, in this Blue Danube Waltz.
Sunday, this is the last performance of the classics portion, and this sounds like some big stuff. And you always bring great singers. I mean, there's Tchaikovsky 4 here. Does that open the concert?
We're going to open the concert with a work by Bruckner. We're going to play Bruckner's Psalm 150, which is a setting for chorus. There's a brief soprano solo, but chorus and orchestra. Incredible work. It's a short work, about 12 minutes long. And then after the Bruckner, we do the Leos Janáček Glagolitic Mass. I am just over the moon about this piece. I learned of it only a few years ago, and I've become somewhat obsessed with it. This will be my second time to conduct the piece, so now I've had the experience of doing the work. I did it with one of my orchestras back east, and I'm now even more obsessed with the piece. It's phenomenal. Glagolitic just means church Slavonic. And Janáček was questioned near the end of his life and later in his writing. He wasn't a religious man at all. And some of his colleagues said, you know, the great composers all wrote great masses. Mozart, Schubert, you know, you don't have a mass. And Janáček sort of flippantly replied, well, I have no interest to write a mass in Latin. Someone provides me with a good organization of the text, you know, in my language, and then I'll give it a go. Well, they took him up on it immediately and presented him with this wonderful glagolitic setting of the text, Church Slavonic, and he felt sort of honor-bound to do it. He gave us this mass for four soloists, orchestra, organ, very prominent. One movement is organ only, so it gives a chance to really get to demonstrate the incredible organ at Pinnacle Presbyterian Church. It's sort of, at one level, it's Verdi meets Janáček Symfonietta, I have to tell you. Such a brilliant piece, and I'm excited for everyone to hear it. And if that isn't enough, and people want to also make sure they enjoy the day and something that they know very well, then we have the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony to finish off our time together, be the last thing the audience hears of this orchestra, this incredible orchestra for the 2015 season.
Bob Moody, thank you very much.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here with you guys.